Welcome to Analyst Talk with Jason Alder. It's like coffee with an analyst, but there's no actual coffee. Each episode, we interviewed an expert in the field of law enforcement analysis to share their career-defining stories and to get their insights on the world. Please join us on recognizing and learning from these brilliant minds as we define the law enforcement analysis profession one episode at a time.
Thank you for joining me. I hope many aspects of your life are progressing. My name is Jason Alder, and today our guest has 19 years of law enforcement analysis experience. He has experience with Broward Sheriff's Office in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, and Bank of America in Charlotte, North Carolina. He's an author, analyst, developer, and fellow Floridian. Please welcome John Canada III. John, how are we doing?
We're doing great.
All right, very good. So what is the most memorable or maybe even the worst use of your name that you've ever heard?
Oh, Canada Dry. Canada Dry by far.
Oh, that's too good. Canada Dry. Yeah. So it's funny. Mindy, who works with me on this show, she couldn't figure out. I just interviewed John Ng from Canada.
Right.
And she couldn't figure out. She thought there was something wrong with the calendar that it was John Canada. She's like, yeah, John Ng's from Canada. Why are you interviewing him twice? I'm like, no, it's a total separate person. It's not. It's John Canada from Florida.
Yeah.
All right. So let's get started then. How did you discover the law enforcement analysis profession?
Well, it's kind of interesting. My original go-to major was going to be architecture.
Okay.
At the time, the math just wasn't cutting it. And I was like, wow, this is a lot of math. I don't know if I can do this. My dad was working for the local government at the time. And I started looking around and I went and applied to do a law enforcement in detention or in the road. And after I went to the academy, I was like, well, I really like the content. I really like the investigative piece. I just don't like the putting myself in danger piece. So that kind of changed that. And that's where I started refocusing my major to criminal justice. And from there, I started off in like a human resources division until I could transfer into crime analysis, which that was in 2002 when I first started in crime analysis. Interestingly enough, combating truancy.
Oh, okay. And that was specific to your task when you got hired as an analyst?
It was specific. For about 8 or 9 years, I was involved in doing all the stats, all the investigative, all the identifying of juveniles that were being truant and how the program was set up, that the program was a partnership between the state attorney, between the school board, and between the sheriff's office at the time. And it was all about reducing daytime crime through truancy enforcement.
Okay. So what kind of data were you bringing to the table to help folks with that cause?
Well, we were pulling in the kids that were skipping school and cross-referencing that with the crimes that were being committed during the day, which mostly was house break-ins and car break-ins. Mostly house break-ins because, you know, people aren't home during the day, they're at work.
Did you have access to the school system data?
Yeah, we did have access to it. We had access to the school board, and we had a direct access to the state attorney with regards to truancy enforcement, because at that time, they were going after the parents when the kids weren't in school, which that has significantly changed. But so for the kids that were not continually in school and the ones that were out committing crime, they were holding the parents accountable because they were still juveniles.
So this is 2002. So I guess thinking back just to those early days, what comes to mind?
The technology is so much different now. Oh my gosh. And even back then, I was creating databases back then. There was one situation where reporting was not really cohesive with the three entities, the state attorney's office, the school board, and the police. So because it was written reports, they were doing it on a report writer, and they would submit a report, And then the report would get printed and sent. And they were not being able to report on the data. For instance, the school resource officers, it wasn't just truancy. They were there in the schools to handle any incidents. And they were teaching classes, SMART, DARE, GREAT. They were teaching all kinds of classes to the kids about the right behaviors to have, how to behave in society, with regards to crime and gangs. And other than the report, there was no way to track it. There was no way to really track how are we impacting? What's our impact here? So once they determined over one summer that errors were being made and things weren't getting reported right, I came up with the idea, which actually that was my first database. I said, hey, let's just build a database. Not knowing how to do it, I'm just telling myself, I'll just figure it out. I started with Microsoft Access. I still use it today. Up to today, I still use it. So I built them a database. Every month they could ask, well, how many reports were done? How many arrests, how many GREAT trainings were taught, how many DARE trainings were taught. And so I gave them a report that had all the schools that we covered and all of those criteria so that they could do their monthly report on impact when the partnerships were asking, okay, so what are we doing? What's the impact or what's the status of this? I was able to query the database that I built and tell them, here's the numbers.
So this is before YouTube. This is before you could go out and essentially just learn how to do almost any programming like you can today. So how did you go about learning Access in order to build this database?
Because we had internet. I went online and found a class where a guy was teaching Microsoft Access. And then actually I bought a series of Microsoft, and that was in 2002. So it's changed even from then. A lot of times. Yeah. So I just kind of followed it along and I trial and error, and there really wasn't a big, big pressure. They weren't pressuring me because when I gave them the idea, they're like, whoa, really? I had to kind of convince them this is the way, because we can't keep doing this flipping through reports game. It takes too long.
How were you getting the data into Access?
I was inputting it. So what would happen was they would give me the reports. I would get the reports from, I want to say, 60 guys.
That's a lot.
Every month. So it wasn't a narrative like you would think. It was just line items. And that's how I built the database to kind of mimic that report. They would give me the report and I would just go through it. I had a lot of drop downs. Like I had the list of schools. I had the list of cities. It became really easy to populate it, because I had a lot of drop downs and a lot of things that were repeating. All the trainings were in a list. Everything was in a list that was repeating. It took like there certain days, like a certain time of the day when the truancy enforcement ended, I still had a few hours each day. So I just entered this stuff then. And then every month I gave them all a deadline. Look, guys, I need your reports before blah, 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 because I need to enter the data for the sergeant.
And then what product were you producing? A PDF?
Yeah, I was just producing a PDF for them.
Yeah, I wish Excel was more like Access in terms of the reporting.
It is. It's like a mini me.
But Excel needs the capability to report on its data in the same way that Access does.
Well, but if they did that, then you wouldn't need one or the other of the products. So that's probably never going to happen.
If I had my way, they would all be grouped together. Like Word, yeah. Access, Excel would all be one platform, Publisher.
Yeah, I've used all of those still things to build different things. I used Publisher once. I had to make a bullying presentation for the school resource officer. So I had to do all the research on bullying at the time, which is now it's much different with social media. It's totally different.
So did you work on this truancy issue your whole time until you left for Bank of America?
No, I was there until Bank of America.
Yeah. Were you still working on truancy that whole time?
Yeah. All the way to the end.
Okay.
Because what ended up happening was the recession or the depression, whatever you want to call it, back in 2007, kind of killed a lot of programs. So I was impacted a little bit by that towards the end. So what ended up happening was for 9 years, I was the solely the truancy analyst. That change started to happen. I became the truancy analyst and the school resource officer analyst. So they kind of split me because they knew one was going away.
How successful do you think you were? Because you were doing this for 10 years. So how would you rate your success?
I really think, even to today, I really think that truancy enforcement was effective in reducing the juvenile daytime crime, because they were out there in the field looking for kids where they were not supposed to be.
I can see where it'd be helpful getting in the who's missing school today information that day. That would be very beneficial.
Yeah, it was helpful. And most of the data we gathered was they all had to fill out forms when they picked up a student and kind of gave us details on the kid. And it helped us to track their recidivism with regards to truancy.
All right. So let's talk about your transfer to Bank of America, because not only do you go to the private sector, you leave Florida entirely and go up to Charlotte, North Carolina.
It was interesting because looking back, I was really not prepared to go from public to private at that time. That being said, it was very interesting because when I first got there, the bank was undergoing a reorg. And it was a time where people were protesting the bank. If you remember back in 2010, 2011, they were protesting the banks and for their practices or lack thereof. So when I got there, initially, they had me on protest, on tracking protests against the bank, against the facilities and all of that. And then that got even too big. They had to build a separate unit just for that.
So what were the type of tasks that you were doing?
We were going on social media and off of there, what they had, a center, a security center that we worked in that had like a 911, had operators that took calls and complaints and stuff from the bank branches and from facilities about things that were happening. So any kind of crime, any kind of incident, any kind of disturbance that was reported. So we gathered that information and we hit social media. Social media at that point was moving along pretty good, and people were using all the platforms, the meetup platforms and the other social media group platforms to say, hey, we're protesting the bank, blah, blah, blah. It's at this time and this day, everybody meet here. So that's where that kind of stuff. So we started tracking that really closely, and that just became a whole spreadsheeting. And mostly because it wasn't law enforcement, we weren't law enforcement. We would just reach out to our partners to let that time it was Charlotte, Mecklenburg County, their police force know if it was happening all over the country, because Bank of America has a huge footprint globally.
Sure.
Anywhere that the protests were being, we were in touch with them to let them know, hey, this is happening or this is going to happen, or be on the lookout. You're going to get a large gathering outside your facility type of thing, so that they were aware ahead of time, that so that they weren't surprised, because you know they're concerned with their employees and their clients or their clientele and their facilities. So it was all structured around that focus, protecting the company assets.
What kind of data did you have access to?
Well, we had all the calls, what I call the calls for service, anything that came into the center, which included video and still pics, and we had all the social media. Where they were, because again, that was right before YouTube. Your YouTube was very young in 2010, 2011, right around that time. So we would get all of that data, and that's how we would track that. But then after that, after they built that one unit, that's when I moved over to start doing serial robber tracking, which that for me, that was the bee's knees. That was fun.
Before we get to that, so how did you discover this job?
At the time, I was searching for federal jobs and it just wouldn't happen.
All right. So this brings us to your analyst badge story, one of two that you have for us. For those that may be new to this show, the analyst badge story is the career-defining case or project that an analyst works on. So it's here working for Bank of America that you start working on serial robberies and you get a pretty good case.
Yeah, I actually, there was actually one that I really remember a lot, and that it was the Grandpa Bandit.
Nice.
Raging up and down the California coast.
So you're dealing with cases that aren't necessarily in North Carolina?
Right. Well, because the North Carolina, I don't know if you've ever heard that North Carolina is like the financial center of the South. It's like New York.
Okay.
Lots of banks are in Charlotte. Huge banks are in Charlotte. So that was their hub. So I was responsible for all of the 50 states. So I would track our incidents that were happening at our bank and suggested that we track the surrounding banks just to kind of see, kind of get a picture of who was getting robbed and when. Mm-hmm. So I started looking for data through the FBI, come to find out they were posting all the incidents because I don't know if you know, the FBI gets triggered at a bank robbery. They're automatically triggered mm-hmm. right away. That's the law enforcement agency that's triggered besides whoever's local. So they put their information and their pics on the site. And at the time, it wasn't really collected and nobody was putting it together between bank robberies, especially like within one state or where there was a state where there was a close border. So I started noticing that there was a lot of similarities and a lot of really close. Hey, this looks like the guy from the one last week down the street. So I started just pulling all of that data together and doing flyers. And some of the flyers, I also at the same time, I was looking back at the flyers that were there in their database, which didn't really have any monkey ear or anything identifying, oh, this guy, Grandpa Bandit or Flaky Hat Bandit or some kind of monkey ear to identify for people, mostly law enforcement. Hey, this is the guy that's done this, this, and this. So I took all of those and kind of rebranded them a little bit and started putting out more with if the media or the FBI hadn't already made the connection and named them, I was giving them a name. I was giving them some kind of monkey ear to identify them so that they, when we send out the flyers to the branches, they're like, oh, that's that guy from last week. So they knew this guy's coming your way based on all the data from that one particular guy that we keep seeing over and over. And so we kind of forecasted with an algorithm and just using a math tool to figure out how he was going to hit, what he was going to hit, what his MO was. And that way we were able to give them an idea. We were kind of conservative. We said between this time and this time where he's looking like he's going to hit within the next few days, he normally hits on this day a week. He normally hits at this time of day. And so they all had their flyers that gave them the what's up, what's coming your way, as well as I was doing the other on that flyer. I had a section that had all the other banks that he hit, including the bank I was working for. They knew, like, you know, here's Bank of America on this corner, two blocks down is a Wells Fargo, three blocks down is a credit union. And so they knew he's in the area. So on that little graphic on the bottom, that he's in the area.
So I am picturing a guy that is in a walker and is hitting the banks at 3 p.m., so he can hit the buffets at 4 p.m. for dinner. That's what I'm, how close am I?
But the funny thing is, this guy was young.
So why was he grandpa?
Because he had the mask he wore.
Okay.
Including the gloves for his hands made his hands look old.
Nice. Okay. So how many did he get altogether before he got caught?
Oh, shoot. I had at one point, at one flyer, I had like 20 or 25 banks. And then finally he screwed up, didn't reject the die pack or the tracker. And then when he left the bank, it exploded.
Oh, all right.
So that's how they got him.
I don't know. You think he got greedy? How much was he getting on average?
It varied because I think the banks were getting keen on what was going on. So they started changing their what was in their tills.
It's fascinating to me because once you identify that it's an individual or a group, it can be fairly easy to predict what's going on next because there's only so many banks. And once you see the pattern of how they're going to operate, you can get to the day and you can get to so many locations because they don't normally hit the same bank twice, as the old saying goes.
Oh, no, but they do.
Oh, they did in this case?
But they do. No, several cases, they several banks, they were just like, They must have, because they either had what had happened, like right before I started with the bank, they started putting up what they call bandit barriers. So now when you go into a bank now, there's no, you can't touch the teller. There's no way you're getting close to the teller in any bank. Most banks have the plexiglass between you and the, and the teller. So that's what they call them, bandit barriers. That way there was no physical connection. Everything was done. You could still see them. You just did it through the plexiglass and through, you know, with the little holes in it.
Yeah. I know one program that Cincinnati started when I was at Cincinnati Police Department was that if you were standing in line at a bank, they asked you to remove sunglasses, your hood. You couldn't
have they did do that.
They started doing that. So, and they just saw some great behavior, people getting out of line and then going down and robbing the bank down the street that didn't have them do that.
Yeah, but now with the pandemic, that kind of just killed that because everybody has a mask on.
That's short time.
Good reason.
Yeah. It's funny. I had Yurissa Walsh on, and she was working for a bank, and she's like, "It's weird that I'm gonna put on a mask and then go into a bank, and I'm not robbing it." So,
which you know, that's all kinds of frustrating for analysts because now we can't ID them.
Yeah,
but we can't use facial recognition on them because it covers too much of their face.
Well, it was hard to sometimes gimmick, depending on the quality of the video.
Yeah, they're better now.
Yeah, these banks have millions of dollars invested in them, and they have a camera that seems like the pixels are from 1985.
Yeah.
So then you were only with Bank of America for a couple of years before you head back south to Broward County.
Well, see, that's where, you know, that's so... So there was some health issues, actually, because I had had epilepsy for so many years. It finally got to the point where this is not working. The medicine wasn't working. So I got sick at that point or got worse. And so I ended up having brain surgery to solve it.
Wow. Did you have seizures as well?
Yeah, I did have seizures.
How often would you have seizures?
Weekly, two or three times a week, maybe.
Wow, really?
They were what they call complex partial. So if you didn't know that I had them, you probably would miss it. But it was disruptive. I mean, for me, for my cognition, for it was disruptive. But for the average person, they really probably didn't notice. And I actually saw a video of what it actually looked like when they had to induce it so they could figure out how they were going to do the surgery. And it was really, it's really not that noticeable unless you know about it.
And it would just last for moments and you would have these a couple times a week?
Yep.
Oh, man. So would you have periods of just blackouts?
I did have one, a couple over 40 years, but not major. I had one when I was 5 where I could vividly remember the whole thing where I had blacked out. The next thing I know, I'm on the ground rolling around. But beyond that, so I had the surgery. It was successful. I came back home.
So what did they remove?
They removed a golf ball size of my temporal lobe and you have two amygdala and you have two hippocampi. They removed one of each on the right side.
And so after that, no seizures?
No seizures. I actually, right after, I had tried to refocus my health and I lost 70 or 80 pounds and became a distance runner.
Wow. Did you notice anything different in your personality or did anybody tell you that, hey, before the surgery, you were one way and after the surgery, you were this way?
Yeah, I feel a little bit of the empathy of things is gone. I have to go a little bit extra now as far as empathy goes in some situations where before I was very empathetic, but now that they did that surgery, it's a little different. To me, still better.
Oh man. Well, I would say so. I mean, so you turned in a little bit of empathy for not having seizures weekly. So yeah. I think that's probably a fair trade as long as you recognize it. And I guess you can't be like a therapist, I guess. That would not be a good profession for you for that.
Yeah.
Empathy.
Yeah. I could probably go through the motions of it, but.
All right. So then you come home.
I come home jobless because when I tried to go back to work, they had a major company-wide layoff that got me out. So I said, dude, back to Florida. Florida, first thing I did was try to get back into the sheriff's office where I knew I was going to be received well because I left them well. I did a detention job for a year and a half before I could get back into an analysis role.
Hi, this is Dawn Reby, 22 plus years in law enforcement analytics and CEO of Excellence in Analytics. And here's our public service announcement of the day. Hire a qualified coach. The process of growth and development is not easy. And quite honestly, many professionals in service-based industries have their wheels spinning for years. It just doesn't work. It doesn't get better. You can only see through your lenses. Hiring a coach is the best thing that I did years ago, and I still have one today. I love the clients we coach. They get results, and those results are real. They build confidence, they create better work-life harmony, they excel in their careers, and they simply have more joy. It is possible. Get yourself there faster by hiring a qualified coach.
You didn't do the dishes?
Well, no, I was busy doing other chores. But my completed chores is up 5 in the last 7 days.
Yeah, but you're still down 13 over the last 28 days.
Well, I see your shopping purchases is up 20% this month.
My spending is still down year to date. In fact, my black shoe purchases are half of what they were this time last year.
Well, thank goodness last year wasn't a normal year.
Plus, I bought you new underwear, so your clothes purchases is up 40% this month compared to last month.
Well, wait, there were no clothes purchases the previous month, Miss Perfect. I didn't know you had the ability to divide by zero.
You should be happy. Your temperature-led policing program has worked great in this house. I have not touched your precious thermostat in the last 6 months.
Millions of homes in the U.S. are impacted by people wanting to be comfortable in their homes. Temperature-led policing. Control the temperature, control the cost.
So then you come back, though, and your first stint with Broward County was as an intel analyst. And the second stint, you become a crime analyst.
Well, I actually was a crime analyst classified as when I was a truancy analyst. That was a crime analyst position.
Oh, so okay.
I came back to a crime analyst role, but things were really different. The technology was really different. It was that the what they were tracking, how they were capturing, the record management system was more robust. Instead of being a report writer, it was just was much better. It was easier to pull. It was easier to get to the data.
And then so what are you concentrating on at this time?
So I'm there in Deerfield and I'm concentrating on property crime, which most of the time, that's what city or municipality analysts do. Most of it's property crime, house break-ins, car break-ins, business break-ins, and then any kind of aggravated battery type of, so anything that fell under what they would call part one crime was the responsibility of the analyst.
And then how many analysts does, I should have asked you that before. When you were first working for Broward County,
I was the only analyst.
You were the only analyst. And then when you come back for your second stint, are you still the only one?
Yes. In that city, yes.
Okay. So this leads us to your second badge story for Deerfield, and you are building a progressive model.
Right. So what ended up happening was I was pulling daily and weekly reports, and it really wasn't, I was doing basic analysis of the day of week type of mapping, and I was using their database to mapping, and I was like, this doesn't seem like it's telling me anything. So I started pulling the data in chunks of 20 days. And then with that group trying to identify for the major crimes, which was the house burglaries, the car break-ins, the business break-ins. Those three were the major ones for property crime. So I would take the data and try to identify, okay, when is this happening? What day of the week, time of day of week? And then, okay, so how are they doing it? So what's the MO? So I pulled the data and then went into the narrative, because the initial part of a record of an incident doesn't always tell you the story. Mm-hmm. So you go into the narrative and you get all of that data. So I developed a PowerPoint that showed different slides for a certain crime for this time period. It would show on one slide day a week, and I would take that data and separate it out from the large data and then put it back into the mapping program and map only that and then show that as the day of week. What's the popular day of week? And then I would have the dots on there, and then I would have them in certain colors, color-coded, so that the command could look at it real quick and know right away what's going on. I did that for time of day and for modus operandi. And for repeat offenders, I had some repeat offenders showing up. I would have little captions saying, it's this guy, he's done this type of crime before. In certain ones, whenever that did show up, to show them the repeating actions or activity of certain actors.
You're dealing with day a week. And so why did you choose 20 days as opposed to either 21 or 28?
Because I figured about 3 weeks was a good time frame. I would pull that data every 3 days and do the report every 3 days, even though it was 20 days. So basically what I did was I pulled the data for that 20 days. I would roll it 3 days and pull the data again, mainly because when incidents happen, it takes about 3 days for them to get into the system. Because until the report is final and submitted, it's not going to show up for the crime analyst. So I ran that same model every 3 days.
So are you running any specific type of statistical test, or is it just frequency and averages?
No, actually, it was basically what I was doing was I was pulling the data from the RMS and then going into narrative, and based on the time frame of the crimes, I was, instead of saying all these crimes happened at 11, 1105, 11, I altered the time frame. So everything that fell within a morning time between 4 in the morning to 10 or 11 o'clock, early afternoon, late afternoon, evening, and then overnight. So I created that criteria so that it would be too difficult to pinpoint all the different, because, you know, the times are not going to always be at 11 or 10:30. So I need to be able to group them better. So I group them that way by giving them a little bit of a range, but not too much where it's like, okay, this is too many. This is too many to focus on in this range or to identify something happening in this range. So I did that kind of range to kind of give them an idea of when it was happening, and then they could see what type of MOs were being used at certain times of the day or at certain days of the week. So they had all of those, they had those three slides. They were all on that same 20-day crime. So they were able to see how the dots were repeating in certain areas for that same crime for day of week, time of day, and MO. And that way they knew, like for instance, I used black for the MO of open car. Your car was left open. You didn't lock it. A lot of times, most of those incidents, it was mostly black because people were leaving their car open. And that was to inform them that, you need to communicate to the public. Hey, between this time and this time, 30 cars got hit because you all leaving your cars open.
Is that the type of actions the executives would do? They would take that information and then it would be some kind of problem solving.
But they either inform the public you need to tighten up on the security of your stuff, or they would create an operation around this particular time of day and day of week to see if they can catch them.
So, and that's still what you're doing today, right?
Actually, now, since I'm in the strategic intelligence division, my focus now is more target centric. But what I do with that is, instead of pulling that data for determining who it is, since I have a target name and location, I give them data based on that location for criminal history and for when they're executing a search warrant, they need to know about the house and everything about the house. And the tool was all about informing the command of the patterns and activities so that they could use their resources in the best way.
All right. I want to move on now. And you recently got your master's degree from Florida State University, and it's a master's in law enforcement intelligence. So can you talk a little bit about that program? Because that's interesting.
It really was interesting. I was taking some of the classes like human intelligence, which is really surrounding how to deal with confidential informants, which I deal with in my current role. We're documenting confidential informants. So it was a good training on how to approach, how to cultivate and get information from and document a potential informant. Along with that, there was classes in management. So law enforcement management, if you're going to be in an administration role, it was really structured around federal, state, and jurisdictional task force type of level reporting and analysis. So we were taught the strategic intelligence analysis, strategic analytical tools. So all different tools that they normally don't teach at the crime analyst level, which helped us to gather and write an intelligence product versus giving crime stats or a crime report. You were giving intelligence, or you were giving them an intelligence level or a federal level quality paper, giving them the history of the target and, you know, bottom line up front, what's the most important things the decision makers or command staff need to know for this target. So it was that type of training. And it was a lot of writing, which to me was surprisingly fun.
Yeah. You mentioned databases. So does that mean you're doing more complicated stuff other than Access?
I'm actually building another Access database. So
I'm still on Access.
Yeah. Well, because I have found the niche that there's a lot of data that police agencies hold that isn't necessarily put into a record management system. So like when we create intelligence reports, that has to get uploaded to an intelligence database, to a secured database for intelligence. But a lot of times they gather data in books, on CDs, and they really can't analyze that or report on it without a database. So I find myself a lot of times in most places, like as a matter of fact, every place, building a database to put all of that information together so that we can go in and say, hey, what happened to this and this and this? And we can just query it and give them data. Instead of agonizing through multiple reports, we just put it all together in one area that they can just query it. They can just add to it. They can take away from it. They can do whatever they want with it once it's built.
Yeah. Don't you find that Access, though, will be slow once it gets working on too many records?
I don't think I ever ran into that problem, because I was doing the initial one I created for a number of years. So every school year, there was easily 700 reports. Wow. Easily. So, and I was entering all the line items from all those reports. So it got pretty big, but it didn't get too big that I couldn't move it. The databases that I built are something that's meant to be some huge monstrous thing that needs security. It's in little niches where they need the data to be together, and they currently don't have it that way.
So who would you recommend should get this master's in law enforcement intelligence?
I recommend it for analysts that have aspirations for the feds or for beyond a city analyst. It's a great, great program. Most of the staff are retired FBI. It really explored a lot of terrorism issues. One of my first classes was political Islam. So it really explored a lot of federal level concerns for global, like what the CIA would investigate, to the states and for the United States as a nation, as well as all the other nuances that, you know, you need to see the see something, say something. And since 9/11, we have the Patriot Act. We have financial intelligence units, which in my studies, I designed a intelligence unit and a financial intelligence unit. That was pretty fun. With all the audit systems and all the audit criteria and everything built in the system, it was pretty neat.
All right, so let's get into some advice that you have for our audience. One of the questions I like to ask is, you've been doing this for almost 20 years. What is something that you thought when you first started in analysis that by 2021, law enforcement would figure it out, but still we're struggling with it today?
Well, there's a couple things. One, and I had really just recently started to notice that law enforcement agencies don't share as much as they could with regards to, we're all chasing the same guys. Mm-hmm. We're all chasing them all around. We're all chasing them. So, and I don't know that it will ever be perfect, but it could be a little bit more cooperative than it currently is.
I mean, it's so tough. I mean, there's what, 17,000 police departments out there in the country, and
that's what makes it hard. It's because everybody has their own, we're responsible for our community type of thing. So anything beyond their main task of doing is stretching their resources. So it's hard, while it just seems that the different levels of agencies would cooperate. You'd think they would cooperate much better.
Yeah.
Than sometimes they often do. And sometimes it's great. They're all in sync and they take down a large group of traffickers or money launderers or narcotics. And it's those times are great. Oh my gosh, they work together. It was awesome.
Yeah.
But then sometimes you'll see where you get disconnect and things get either dropped or not followed through on like they could have been. And it takes longer to catch them than it would have had they all been talking to each other.
And you said there was a second one that you wanted to talk about?
It seems like for crime analysis, your audience as a city crime analyst is your detectives. Your detectives are your audience. They're the people that you are serving. Them and the statistics for the command is what keeps them going. You know, doing the flyers for them, giving them leads. So it seems like the analyst, it has to go to the detectives. Maybe it should be a little more of, hey, I need this. Can you get this for me? And I'm starting to see some of that now, which is great. But I would have thought that you would have feel a little more embedded or a little more involved in investigation so that you knew, or so that if you saw something, you could say, hey, I saw this thing in here. It looks like it relates to your case. Type of relationship.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of those deals. Everybody's got to sell to something, right? If you're an assistant director or assistant chief, you're selling your ideas to the chief, and you can work your way all the way down. And even the detectives are making cases, and they're either selling their idea to their supervisor or selling their idea to the prosecutor on what direction to go with the case. And so for analysts, they have to sell. Even if they hear no 100 times in a row, they have to keep plugging, keep fine-tuning their message and their sale to get through to all of their clients.
And that's what I had to do. I started pulling data and looking in the pawn databases and just delivering pawn tickets to the detectives. Go get them. He just pawned it yesterday. He stole it the other day. So you had to kind of just prove to them, look, I'm your biggest asset.
All right. And then what is something that an analyst can study today that will be important 5 years from now? It'll give them a good return on their investment.
I really think social media for investigations is 100% necessary. It teaches you tools on how to take a name, take an email, take a photo, and really try and figure out what their social media is saying. Because sometimes it's not as heavy as it used to be, but these criminals, they still can't help themselves. They're still tweeting it and putting it out there and just making it easy for us. You just have to find it. You just have to find where they tweeted it or what handle they're using. So social media tells you a lot more than you would think. You just have to pretty much stalk everybody. So when you're stalking them on social media, that's how you find out the things that nobody saw or nobody reported, but they're kind of just giving it away.
And then do you have any training specifically for social media?
There was a training, a social media for investigators training that I believe that I don't believe the guy is doing it anymore. His name is Mike Nelson, I think it was, but I'm not quite sure of the name, but he was pretty good. I took his class a couple times and he was good about telling us how to search and what to search and how to take a target and find out their family and find out who they talk to and where they frequent. So it was very useful as an investigative tool.
Okay. Do you have any other training that you would recommend to our audience?
So if you're new to being a crime analyst, any crime analysis training, because there's so many trainings out there. So one specific one really isn't the end all be all. But something that tells you how to forecast crime, develop the algorithm, how to take a set of data and determine the anomalies, the patterns with regards to the suspect, the incident, the timing, the modus operandi. So anything that teaches you those skills is great for you being able to really manipulate the data that you are getting in your record management system.
All right. And so what's next for John Canada, the third, the crime analyst?
Well, I just want to keep on building. I see it seems like I am getting that architect job because it seems like everywhere I go, I'm creating another database, creating another solution for data.
Yeah, but you need to get your own server. You need to get on a network database and graduate up to SQL. And really be working some data and having some power and really building the skyscrapers.
Yeah, I'm actually, that's funny you say that. I'm actually doing some SQL coursework. That's already slated for the growth potential.
I think you'll like it. I really do. All right, so let's move on to personal interest. And you had mentioned it before that with your surgery, you became a runner. You then wrote a book. Running to a New Beginning, My Brain Rewired, published in 2015. Just take us through that journey a little bit about becoming a runner and then the decision to write a book and what that process was like for you.
Well, becoming a runner was a way for me to do more than just walking, because when I had originally lost all the weight, it was me walking it off. That became, okay, I need a little more challenge here. So I started running a mile, 2 miles, 3 miles, entered a 5K. And then I thought, how long is a half marathon? So I was like, oh, so then I started, then I ran a 5K. And then if you run a 10K, that's like 6 miles. So I started progressively running further and further. The March after my surgery, which was in February of 2013. So by the March of the next year, I had run my first half marathon. And then by the end of that year, before I left North Carolina, I ran a marathon.
What was your time?
I believe it was 4:56.
I think mine was 4:54, my first one.
So and that was my first one, but I had run one since then. Because I came back to Florida, but I had to get back to work. Life got complicated. I ran a few other half marathons, but my best time, I think, was 2:15 on a half marathon.
So then what made you decide to write the book?
For me, it was therapy because, you know, I just had my brain changed. So it was just how to get my story out there and say it was really at the time I was, why didn't I have this solution before? I was doing medicine for 40 years and this was the solution. It just, it probably was not as great as it was when I originally could have used it years back, but it became a platform for me to say, you know, if you qualify this, you can have the surgery and still do great things.
What was some feedback you got from the book?
Well, I didn't market it great, so it didn't go off. And it really was more for me about writing it and getting it published than it was really, really hitting the whole world with it. It was really a good bit of therapy for me. And it helped me start get my writing going.
Have you always been a natural writer?
No, that's the funny thing.
So yeah, and we talked about this in the prep call. I find myself to be a bad writer. In fact, I'm doing this podcast because this is my way of writing a book. I can just have each one of these be chapters in the book.
Yeah, as long as you have a strong interest in something, it just flows. Mm-hmm. You only have a really passionate interest in something, and it just comes out. Like in my master's, I found myself relating what I was learning to a lot of stuff that I had learned already as an analyst. So that, yeah, that just fueled it that much more.
All right. Well, our last segment to the show is Words to the World. And this is where I give the guest the last word. John, you can promote any idea that you wish. What are your words to the world?
Well, I really want to say for new analysts in the field, we know that crime's not going anywhere. The crime that we don't know about is huge. It's larger than you can imagine. That being said, the field of crime and intelligence analysis is still like a teenager or early adult stages where the technology is always changing. There will always be plenty to learn. And the field of crime analysis is a great career, especially if you like solving puzzles, finding solutions, supplying the missing piece that someone else is looking for.
Very good. Well, I leave every guest with, you've given me just enough to talk bad about you later. But I do appreciate you being on the show, John. Thank you so much, and you be safe.
Yep.
Thank you for joining us today on Analyst Talk with Jason Alder. We hope you not only enjoyed the show, but also learned something new. For more information on our guests and information relating to today's topic, please visit our website at leapodcast.com. Special thanks to The Rough and Tumble for our theme song. For more of their music, you can visit their website at theroughandtumble.com. Also, thanks to Kyle McMullen for our show logo. For more of his design, please visit his website at moderntype.com. The show is hosted, recorded, and edited by Jason Alder and written by me, Mindy. You can contact us both via the LEA Podcast website. Please join us again next time as we interview another expert in this great field.